U.S. sales are up 20% for June on strong demand for a variety of vehicles. The company's managed by Italy's Fiat, and it says its best-selling Ram pickup is up 12% over a year before. It also says demand for its Chrysler 300 sedan is up, while the Fiat 500 small car has more than doubled its sales over June of 2011. Chrysler's sales increase is about on pace with analyst predictions for the industry as a whole. Chrysler entered bankruptcy and received a taxpayer bailout, and Fiat has been responsible for most of its turnaround. And Microsoft says it is absorbing more than a $6.2 billion charge on slow online advertising. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure the future of fish and fishing in America's oceans at pewtrusts.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
Burma is one of the poorest countries in Asia. A long period of military rule has kept the country from developing, either politically or economically. But that may be starting to change, and one sign of that change was the recent election to parliament of the country's leading opposition figure, Aung San Suu Kyi. In this hour of Focus, we will try to review recent events in Burma as we talk with Christina Fink from the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She's a cultural anthropologist. She's done live writing about Burma, including the book Living Silence in Burma, Surviving Under Military Rule, published by Zed Books. She has also worked as a coordinator for the Open Society Institute's Burma Project. And she's joining us from Washington. We have a high-quality connection this morning. We're pleased to be able to do that. And also we're pleased to have her on the program to talk. And Professor Fink, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. Maybe we could start by talking a little bit about the April elections brought Aung San Suu Kyi to parliament. And I think one, not only do you have to acknowledge that she is the leading opposition figure in Burma, but she is probably one of the most famous political dissidents in the entire world. So certainly that caught people's attention. Now, we can talk about the background and go back a little bit further, but let's just start there. How important was this?
Well, it's hugely significant because Aung San Suu Kyi had been under house arrest for most of the past 20 years. And she was the person that the military government had been most afraid of because of her international reputation. She's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And she has the power to really mobilize the people of Burma. And so the fact that they allowed her to run in the election and now to take a seat in parliament really signifies that the government wants to turn a new page.
Mm-hmm. Now, she and her party did win a significant number of seats, but because of the way the parliament is structured, it's automatic that a certain number of seats are held by the military and its supporters. So what can you say about, at least at this point, about the makeup of parliament and the continuing influence of the military?
Right. Well, actually, there was an election in November 2010 for the entire parliament. And at that time, Aung San Suu Kyi's party boycotted. They said that they were not going to run in the election because they didn't accept the constitution. And also, the electoral laws said that her party could only run if they asked her to leave the party, because at that time she was still under house arrest. And so the party said, we're not going to go along with that, and they boycotted the election. But the electoral laws were changed for the by-election in April this year, which was to fill some seats that had been made vacant by people who took positions in the cabinet, in the government. And so she did participate in those elections, and her party won almost all the seats that that were up for grabs. However, as you said, a certain number of seats are reserved for the military. 25% of the seats in the parliament are reserved for the military. And most of the other seats are held by a party that is loyal to the military government, that was created by the military government. So the Democratic groups really only hold a small number of seats in the parliament, but I think that people are really looking to them for direction in the parliament, and they will likely have a much larger influence than the number of seats that they actually hold. Mm.
There, I think perhaps people might remember that there was a question about whether or not Aung San Suu Kyi and her members of her party would, having been elected, would actually take the oath of office, which necessitates their having to pledge to safeguard the Constitution, which includes this provision that 25% of the parliamentary seats go to the military. They of course have said very clearly in opening that they're interested in seeing this change. So there was this question about, well, could they in fact promise to uphold the Constitution as it existed? They did in fact do that. How serious an obstacle was that?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, this process of trying to move toward democracy in Burma is interesting because it was initiated by the former military regime. And so the military leaders have made some steps toward the democracy movement, and the democracy movement has to decide to what extent are they going to stick completely to their principles and to what extent are they going to compromise in good faith with the assumption that the military leaders are serious about moving forward on democratization. And so this was really one of the first hiccups in that process. And Aung San Suu Kyi and the other members of her party said, we can say that we'll respect the Constitution, but we can't say that we'll safeguard the Constitution, because their ultimate desire is to change the Constitution. But in the end, there was a lot of pressure from other people in society and also internationally to try to compromise with the military government on this, because to change the oath is actually, it requires a constitutional amendment, and that would be a lengthy process, and it would really delay Aung San Suu Kyi and her party from being able to participate in the parliament. Mm. And so a decision was made to go along with that. And I think that that's important, because it shows that there will be these moments where it's not clear how to proceed, but that they can be overcome if reason prevails.
Mm-hmm. Just I have a caller here. I promise I won't make them wait too long, but let me just go one further point here. And as you said, the victory in the by-elections in April of Aung San Suu Kyi and some of her party members was very, very significant. There also, though, has been now, we're into a interesting period of change that goes back a little bit more than a year, with the election of a man who was a general, the current president, Thein Sein, who has really, I think, more than anybody before him, moved in the direction of political reform. What is motivating that?
Yeah, well, that's a question that we don't have a complete answer to yet, but there seem to be a few factors. One is the fact that Burma really had become very reliant on China as its primary international ally and business partner, and that was an issue of growing concern for people in the government, as well as for civilians and members of the democratic movement. To be too dependent on any one country isn't a good policy, and the government itself realized that they needed to move away from China and have a more balanced relationship with countries in the international community. And I think the other thing is that before Thein Sein became the president, he was the prime minister, which under the old government was not a very powerful position. But he did have to travel to other countries in the region. And the generals had been so isolated before this that many of them had very little travel experience outside of the country. And so they had this false image of where Burma stood. And when Thein Sein, as prime minister, traveled to Cambodia, Vietnam, and other countries in Southeast Asia and saw the extent to which they had advanced beyond Burma, it was a real wake-up call for him. And, you know, he and others in the government were aware that Burma is a very rich country in terms of natural resources, and there's no reason why Burma should be lagging so far behind, and that fundamental changes needed to be made in order to enable the country to really prosper the way it should.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the other things, and I suppose that it's the kind of thing that one could make too much of, but one of the other things that I have read is that after the very serious devastation of the country by a cyclone, I guess when we would call a tornado, and this is Cyclone Nargis, which this was in May of 2008, killed a lot of people, did a lot of destruction, that when Thein Sein had gotten out and seen this, he was very personally affected by it and felt very frustrated and unhappy about the inability of the government to respond to the people's needs. And that somehow, I think some people think that if for him, that was an important turning point. Do you think that is the case?
That's possible. I think another interesting point about the cyclone was that the government originally did not allow international humanitarian organizations to come in and assist the cyclone victims mm-hmm. because they were so worried about their own security. They were worried that international organizations would have contact with local people. Local people would talk about their frustrations with the government and that somehow this could undermine the government's control. But finally, after pressure from the Regional Association of Southeast Asian Nations and also the UN, the government did allow international organizations to come in. And in fact, there were no security problems, and the relief effort went quite smoothly. And I think that this went some way to allaying the fears of the military generals that opening up to the world would necessarily mean that they would be putting themselves in danger and their positions in danger. They felt that that was perhaps a process that they would be able to manage after all. So I think that was important as well.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Christina Fink. She is a professor of practice of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs. That's at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Burma, and the questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. Others are welcome. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, way back in 1989, Burma renamed itself Myanmar because it rejected the name imposed upon it at independence by the British colonial imperial regime that occupied the land that it called Burma. And today, Myanmar is recognized by the United Nations Organization and ASEAN and many other organizations and states in the world, except by the United States government that still insists on using the British colonial imperial epithet Burma precisely in order to insult them. This is their sovereign right under international law to rename their state if they want to. And the fact that you, Professor Fink, continue to use the epithet of Burma, to me, indicates that you are doing nothing more on this program but repeating the State Department party line on Myanmar. Thank you.
Well, you may respond to that any way you like.
Okay. You know, the country is known as Burma or Myanmar interchangeably inside the country, and Burma is considered a little bit more informal than Myanmar. The British used, they anglicized Burma into Burma. And as the caller rightly noted, in 1989, the government decided that they did not want to use the British terms for both the name of the country and also the name of many of the cities in the country, which had been anglicized in English. And they wanted to use the Burmanized forms of those names. But the thing was, at that time, you know, the military regime had staged a coup in late 1988 and suppressed the democracy movement, which instead of Myanmar. Now, it's an issue that the government is very sensitive about, and the government would like the United States and all countries to use Myanmar. But until this time, so far, the democracy movement has said that they still prefer the term Burma. For myself, as an academic, to be honest, I use Burma and Myanmar interchangeably. Academics, when they write, we have to use Burma/Myanmar, which is very awkward. I have no problem with either name in the of the country, and I know that for the U.S. government that it would be much easier for them to have the government and the democracy movement agree on one term, whatever it is, Burma or Myanmar, but it would make it easier for everybody, and I'm sure that that's going to happen soon.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Also, email questions are fine, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Christina Fink from the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about Burma. At the risk of further antagonizing our caller, let's talk about the interest here of the United States, because clearly the Obama administration is focusing on Asia. You talked about the government of Myanmar, Burma, being interested in perhaps being less dependent on China. And the United States certainly has an interest in, let us say, offsetting the power of China in the region. Is the government of Burma, are they courting the United States? I mean, are they interested in playing off the two countries against one another?
Well, I think Burma or Myanmar and the other countries in the region would very much like to see the United States playing an active role in Southeast Asia. And it's not that they want the U.S. and China to have an antagonistic relationship and to have those battles play out in their countries, but they would like to have a balanced relationship with both China and the United States. So for the Burmese government, you know, they really had very tense relationships with the United States. We don't have a U.S. ambassador in Burma. And the relationships have been very fraught because of the sanctions and the U.S. government's real frustration with the government's previous unwillingness to stop human rights abuses, for the number of political prisoners that have languished in jails in Burma, and also for the conflict in the ethnic areas that's been waged by the military. But at this time, both countries really see an interest in improving those relationships, in part in order to offset China's influence in the country. But also the U.S. is more interested in Asia in general, and U.S. businesses, of course, have been pushing for a long time to be able to enter and work in Burma. So I think that it's a number of interests that are coming together at the same time. And many people in Burma believe that with the lifting of U.S. sanctions and a warmer relationship between the U.S. government and the Burmese government, prosperity in the country will be possible, and that that's been impossible because of the fact that the Burmese government in the past both had poor economic policies in place and because it was so disconnected from the rest of the international community.
I think that if I remember correctly now, that the United States has said that there will be now sending an ambassador to Burma for the first time in a long time. Has this person hasn't been, they haven't said who this person is going to be or when they would be on place?
They actually announced last Thursday that Mitchell is the person who's been named to be the ambassador. He still has to go through the approval process in the Senate, the confirmation process. But, you know, there's been bipartisan agreement on Burma, which is interesting. It's one of the few issues perhaps in the U.S. government or in the Congress today where you do see broad bipartisan support for the policy on Burma. So I think that it's likely that he will be approved quite quickly. And he will be going to Yangon. And that will also mean that the Burmese side will appoint an ambassador to Washington, D.C. And on the same day, the U.S. government announced, or Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced, that the U.S. was suspending some of the sanctions on Burma. We have a number of sanctions, including an arms embargo, which will stay. But this will allow American businesses to invest in the country as long as they are not working directly with military companies or companies that are closely associated with cronies connected to the military. And also there will be a lifting of restrictions on the use of dollars, of U.S. money in Burma. So before, Burmese were not able to use dollar accounts, even through American banks in the region. And so that's going to be lifted, and there will be much greater American assistance to the government and humanitarian assistance in the country. So this is a real change. But the U.S. government made clear that at this point they're only suspending the sanctions. They aren't going to be permanently revoked until they're sure that the process of democratization is really irreversible.
Let's talk with another call. This is also someone in Champaign. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having this guest on today. I have sort of a question, I guess. As our guest is well aware, Burma, Myanmar has many different ethnic groups. And when you mentioned the cyclone earlier, when this happened, I was one of many people who was frustrated that no aid was being allowed through. And then about a week later, it came out, I believe in the New York Times, that the areas that had sustained some of the most damage were also areas that had ethnic insurgencies going on. And I'm really curious how much of not allowing aid in was, you know, we don't want outsiders to see how bad it was, which we had serious suspicions about that. But how much of not allowing aid in was we're trying to, you know, kind of slowly kill off or starve or injure the ethnic insurgencies and make them go away?
Right. Thank you for your call. In fact, the ethnic insurgencies are primarily in eastern and northern Burma, and the cyclone hit southwestern Burma, and you know, just to the west of Rangoon, the former capital, which is now called Yangon. And that is an area of mixed population. There are a number of Karen people there. And so one of the big insurgencies in eastern Burma is a Karen insurgency. Mm-hmm. Some of the people from the Delta have in the past been supportive of that Karen insurgency, or members of families have moved from the Delta area to eastern Burma in order to join the Karen insurgency. So there have been military operations in that area in the past in order to ensure that the Karen insurgency didn't spread to the Delta area where the cyclone hit. But at the time of the cyclone, there was no insurgency, and the Karen population is very mixed with the Burman population and other people who live in the Delta. So I don't think that it was an effort to try to undermine the Karen or their insurgency in any way. There were questions at the time about whether equal amounts of relief aid were being provided to the various communities in the Delta. Much of the aid went through religious institutions. So the churches, for instance, distributed a lot of aid through their own church networks, and the Buddhist monasteries also distributed a lot of aid through their networks. And so there were some instances where there were feelings that maybe the churches had more aid in some areas than the monasteries, so Christians were perhaps getting more support than Buddhists. But I think that there was no intention on anyone's part to try to prevent certain groups of people from getting aid. It was more a question of really state incapacity to ensure that everybody got equal access to aid.
Does that get at the caller's question? Do you want to follow up?
I think that's okay. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you. Well, let's talk further about this, because you've written about this, and I know a lot of people have written about this, the fact that one of the great challenges that the country faces is the fact that there have been these ethnic insurgencies, these battles going on between these kinds of groups and the central government, and this has been going on pretty much since Burma became independent. So we're talking about decades now. This is something where I think the current government has tried to deal with this by at least entering into some ceasefire agreements with some of these groups. Where exactly does all of this stand now? And perhaps the more basic question is really what is this about?
Right. Well, let me go back to the beginning, which is that under British colonial rule of Burma, the country was really divided into a central area that was directly administered by the British government, and then the frontier areas, which were administered indirectly. So the British colonial officers made agreements with ethnic leaders in the mountainous areas of the country and said, you know, you can continue to rule your areas as long as you agree to be loyal to the British and to pay taxes. And so at the time of independence, the British said, we are willing to grant you independence if these two parts of the country can come together as one. And so Aung San Suu Kyi's father, General Aung San, negotiated with ethnic leaders and said, let's form a union, and you will be respected as equal partners in this union. And for a couple of the states, they were actually given the right to secede after 10 years if they weren't satisfied with the arrangements. If they felt like they weren't being treated fairly, if they didn't want to be part of the union, then they could secede. But for the Karen, the group that the caller asked about, they actually did not participate in these talks because they had much larger demands than some of the other groups and felt that their demands weren't going to be honored. The Karen population is concentrated in eastern Burma, but then there are Karen scattered throughout lower Burma and mixed with other population groups. And so the issue of how do you represent this larger population has been a really challenging issue. And the Karen struggle for political power started in 1949, 1 year after independence. And gradually, other groups became disaffected with the government. This was even in the democratic period in the 1950s. They felt that the government wasn't really giving equal attention to the ethnic states, that all the money in the national budget was really staying in central Burma, not going to the ethnic areas. And there were various other policies which exacerbated tensions and led members of many of the different ethnic groups to take up arms against the central government. And there were ceasefires in the late 1980s and early 1990s that stopped much of the fighting in eastern and northern Burma. But the government at that time, which was still a military government, didn't really make any effort to give any political concessions to these groups. And they said, we've been fighting for so long, not just For economic deals, which the military was willing to grant, but for political rights. And if you're not going to talk about our political rights, then, you know, the ceasefire is really meaningless. And so that's where things stood until about a year ago. And under President Thein, he's made a real effort to set up a process that will go beyond ceasefires and lead to an actual political settlement of these insurgencies. And at this point, there are ceasefires with basically all of the ethnic groups except for one, the Kachin group, which is in the far north, and they border on China. There's still fighting going on in that area. But he has reformed the peace team, and he hopes that they will be able to make a ceasefire agreement with the Kachin, and then that all of these groups will, together with the government, work toward a peace agreement that would include a political settlement, which means granting some degree of political autonomy to the ethnic states. And that's the only way that this is going to be resolved. And, you know, the military has been unwilling to accept that for 50 years, but I think that at least some people in the military today realize that only if they are willing to grant some degree of political autonomy to the ethnic states can these conflicts ultimately be resolved.
In this hour of focus, we are talking with Christina Fink. She is professor of practice of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She is the author of a number of books and articles and other kinds of writing about Burma, including the book Living Silence in Burma, Surviving Under Military Rule. She's also worked as coordinator for the Open Society Institute's Burma Project. She's a cultural anthropologist. She's talking with us from Washington. For as far as Burma is concerned, if they could move in the direction of a more democratic government, establish normal relations with the United States and other countries, and what potential do you think that the country has in terms of development in ways that would benefit the people of Burma?
Well, Burma is largely an agricultural country. About 75% of the people in Burma are still farmers or living on the land. And so what's really important is to be able to develop the agricultural economy. The agricultural economy has been held back by the military government in the past, which has controlled the export of rice, which is Burma's main crop, and many of the other crops, and which has also really prevented farmers from being able to get the money they need to invest in their farms, because loans were only possible through state banks. There's a state agricultural bank, but the amount of money that the state bank provided to farmers was so little that they really couldn't do much to develop their farmland or to mechanize their agricultural practices. And so this is an area that will be really important in terms of being able to ensure that the ordinary person in Burma benefits from the economic changes that are beginning to take place. The country is, as I said earlier, has a number of natural resources, including oil, gas, rubber, timber, and gems. And so, of course, these are already being exploited by the government and companies that are allied with the military or that are allied with people who are close to the government. So you do see a lot of wealth coming in terms of for a very narrow slice of the population in the country. But until you can really address the agricultural sector, I don't think that the benefits are going to accrue to the ordinary person. And another issue that's really important today is land confiscation and land rights. We've seen reforms in the political system. We see economic policy reforms, but there haven't been any reforms of the judicial system yet. And the courts really have been in the hand of the executive branch of the government and continue to follow the will of the executive branch of government today. They're not serving as an independent branch of government. And so farmers who see their land taken by businessmen who are well-connected feel that they aren't able to contest that. They aren't able to go to the court and get a fair hearing. And so the issue of land confiscation is really threatening farmers throughout the country in both the ethnic states and in central Burma. And so it will be very important for the international community to also keep an eye on that and to see or do what they can to facilitate the development of an independent judicial system and respect for land rights.
to the phones again. We'll talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line number one.
Hello?
Yes.
Could you please tell me what language is spoken in Burma? And if the answer is Burmese, is that a Semitic language or an Indo-European language?
Yep, it's Burmese, and it's part of the Tibeto-Burman family of languages. That's the main language in central Burma, but each ethnic group has its own language, and so there are a number of languages in the country.
But you mean the language is not Semitic and it's not Indo-European?
No, it's not. It's part of the Tibeto-Burman.
So if one wanted to speak the language, one would have to simply learn an entirely different language.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah. But there are a number of other ethnic languages which are not related to Burmese, you know, directly. And so this is also an issue of contention in the country because particularly for people who've grown up in the areas where the armed ethnic groups have been which are under the control of the armed ethnic groups, people have only learned their own language and perhaps English, but in some cases they really haven't learned Burmese well, and so they speak broken Burmese. And for some people, Burmese is seen as the enemy language.
Oh.
And so this is an issue that will have to be dealt with. I think at the national level, it's clear that Burmese will continue to be the primary language, but at the state level, in each of the ethnic states, there are certainly people who are pressing for an education system where people would be taught in their native language first or together with Burmese, and that perhaps the ethnic languages would be used, you know, in state governments or at the local government level. So this is something that's going to be a major issue as the country really opens up and tries to resolve the conflicts in the ethnic states.
Would you say, in general, the second language is English?
Well, I would say for ethnic people, the first language is their native language, and the second language is depends where they live. Generally Burmese, but in some cases English or something else. In some cases it's Chinese. Along the China border, you know, there are a lot of local communities who've had Chinese teachers teaching their children. So in some cases it's Chinese.
Uh-huh.
So it's very mixed and complicated, and it really depends from place to place. So I think, you know, these kinds of issues are very challenging for the central government because the central government is used to having a policy that is applied universally throughout the country, but in fact you have very different situations in various parts of the country, and that's what the struggle for autonomy has been about. It's about saying we want to see the differences in our areas respected, and we want policies to fit with the issues that we have in our own areas. And so whether the government is really going to be able to be responsive to that is a challenge.
Is there an English language, how can I say it, introduction to Burmese? I mean, if you wanted to learn the Burmese language, is there an English book you could buy to learn it from?
Yes, there is. I don't know if I'm allowed to promote a particular book.
As long as you have no interest in it, I guess.
I don't have any interest in it, but I would recommend John O'Kell's language books. And you can find, I think, you can find the information about those on the Northern Illinois University website, which has a Center for Burma Studies. And there are tapes, probably there are CDs now, that go along with those books so that you can just learn the spoken if you want, or you can also take on the written language as well, and those are separated into different textbooks.
Oh, I see. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, for anybody who has just tuned in, I'd like to introduce the guest, Christina Fink. She is Professor of Practice of International Affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Burma, and questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you also may send an email question if you'd like to do that. That's will-talk, will-talk, at illinois.edu. To come back to talk a little bit about Aung San Suu Kyi here for a moment, I think in the before the April election, there were some things written about her suggesting that she was now really embarking on a new phase of her career, or perhaps one that was at least different from being opposition spokesperson, someone who had for a long time had been officially under house arrest. So she was now actually out campaigning, and having been elected to the parliament then, she's going to have to be involved in governing. And people will, I'm sure, judge her by a different set of standards. And I suppose those standards being what can she achieve? What can she and her party accomplish? Do you think that is going to be that's going to be difficult for her now? Will people expect things that they had not expected before?
I think it is going to be challenging. If you look at what voters were saying in leading up to the election, you know, the main thing that they want to see improved is the economy. They want to see jobs. They want to see, prosperity. They want to see opportunity, economic opportunity. And while there has been reform at the political level, for the ordinary person on the ground, they haven't seen any changes yet in the past year. And so many of the NLD candidates said that, you know, they promised to their constituents that we will deliver economic reform, we will deliver prosperity to you. That's what we're going to try to do. But whether they will be able to do that or not isn't clear, because the process of economic development isn't one that can be done in a day or a month or even a year. And the process is likely to be a lot slower than most people would like. And so whether people will get frustrated with that and the fact that things aren't moving as quickly as they would like, how much time they're going to give Aung San Suu Kyi and the opposition to really make policies or to influence the parliament to make policies that will lead to visible improvements in their standard of living isn't clear. I think that Aung San Suu Kyi is going to have to work very closely with President Thein Sein, and she's interested in doing that. She is the head of a small opposition party in parliament, but at the same time, she represents the will of the majority of the people in the country. And so she has this very interesting position because she's kind of larger than life, in a sense. And I think that and international governments as well really look to her to tell them how things are going and what would be appropriate policies toward the country. So she is in a position of power that's greater than her actual position in parliament suggests. And hopefully she and President Thein Sein will be able to work well together, and there will be at least people will see that economic prosperity is coming, even if they don't see direct changes in their lives immediately. They have to see that there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991, was not able to accept the prize personally. Her fear was apparently that if she left the country, they'd never let her back. And now the plan is that she is actually going to go and will be accepting the prize?
That's right. She'll be going in June. And I think it's going to be a really exciting time for her because she hasn't been able to leave the country for over 20 years. And so just to be able to get out and walk around freely, which she hasn't been able to do either. I mean, even since she's been free, she's got bodyguards everywhere she goes. And, you know, there's still security concerns as well. And so I think it's going to be a very liberating and energizing experience for her. And hopefully we'll also attract people who maybe haven't been following what's going on in Burma and get them interested in what's happening in the country and supportive of the changes that she's trying to make there.
Hmm. Well, once again, we have a couple of minutes left. If someone wants to call in and can do that quickly, we'll get the call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're talking here about Burma with Christina Fink from George Washington University. Well, what now should we be looking for or following or paying attention to within the next months or year in Burmese politics?
Well, the most crucial thing in the next year is the peace process in the ethnic states, because getting from ceasefire to political settlement is going to be a very challenging process. And I think that for the government side, you know, as well as for the opposition side or the ethnic nationalist side, both sides know what they want, but they don't really have a good sense of the various mechanisms that they might be able to use in order to enable a compromise that would solve, you know, that would satisfy to a certain degree both sides. And so they really need the assistance of technical advisors and people in the international community who can give them good advice on how to move forward with this process and how to handle the moments when the process seems to be going in the wrong direction. How can you get people back on board? How can you find ways to get through the impasses that are going to occur? Because from the military side, they certainly don't want to give up control of these territories. The military agenda has always been to try to establish control over all of the territory within its boundaries. And it still has not achieved that objective, but it's never given up any territory that it's actually been able to take control over. And so the idea of actually rolling back that control is anathema to the military. And yet, on the other hand, the ethnic groups are saying, well, if we don't have some degree of political autonomy in our areas, then this whole ceasefire process is meaningless. So there's going to be have to be some very skillful negotiation and support for this process to succeed. And if it doesn't succeed, if the country reverts to civil war, then I think it really jeopardizes the entire political reform process as well as the prospects for economic prosperity in the country. And then looking beyond that, the next general election will be in 2015. And so that's already very much in the eyes of the government and also the democratic movement. You know, what's going to happen in that election? Will it actually be a free and fair election? Will the Democratic parties be able to compete and win that election? Will there be obstacles that will be thrown in their way that will prevent that or not? Mm-hmm. And so making sure that the process leading up to that will guarantee a free and fair election is going to be very important.
And would we expect to see Aung San Suu Kyi stand for president?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, certainly there are many people who would like her to stand for president. She hasn't said anything about that yet. There's also another very interesting candidate, another former military general, Shui Man, who's the Speaker of the Lower House of Parliament, very ambitious and very eager to see economic reform in the country. And he has also really transformed the parliament into a place of political power and activity in a way that was not expected at the time of the new constitution was written. And even a year ago, people expected that the parliament would really just rubber stamp the decisions that were made by the executive branch of government. But it hasn't turned out that way. Shui Man has made the parliament very dynamic. They've challenged the executive branch on a number of occasions. And so he's also a contender for that position. So it may turn out to be a very interesting election. People see it in the country as really the turning point of whether the democratization process will be irreversible or not. It will really rest on how that election plays out.
We have one caller here, one more caller. Here's someone in Fithian. I'll talk with them. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Good
yes.
morning. What do you think about going there as a tourist? Is it safe? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. You know, in the past, the Democratic opposition movement had discouraged tourists from going to Burma because their feeling was that the money you spent there would largely end up in government coffers through taxes on hotel rooms and the fact that you needed to change your money into an artificial currency called foreign exchange currency, which was a way for the government to ensure that they got much of the revenue of tourist dollars coming into the country. But the Democratic movement has really relaxed its stance on that, and tourists are welcome in the country by both sides. It's a safe place to travel, perhaps because the military has had such a tight grip. So, yes, certainly if you're interested, you should go, and you should really try to talk to people and find out what are their feelings about the current situation, what do they want to see, and it's a beautiful country. There are certainly still some areas in the north of the country where it's not safe to to go and where you wouldn't be able to go. But anywhere that the government allows you to go would be safe and I think would be a wonderful experience for you and for the people you meet who, you know, were very unhappy about the fact that they had been cut off from the rest of the world for so long and are eager to engage with people from other countries.
What, just we have about a minute or so left, what has become of the last president, Than Shwe?
Than Shwe has retired at a beautiful home in the new capital, Naypyidaw, and he has been very quiet since President Thein Sein took over. And there are a lot of rumors swirling around about whether he supports what's happening or doesn't support what's happening. But what we can say is that he hasn't interfered in any direct way. He hasn't impeded the reforms that have taken place so far. He hasn't come out in public saying he supports them either, but the process seems to be moving along without any obstacles from his side, which is a good thing. And it's not clear whether he is happy with what's happening, but certainly he wanted to ensure that he and his family would be secure, that their physical security would be guaranteed, and that they could live out the rest of their lives in a situation of personal security. And that certainly seems to be the case so far.
That seemed to be one of the mysteries here, along with the mystery of Thein Sein himself, why it is that the previous president hasn't really thrown any obstacles in his way.
That's right. You know, there's still so much we don't know about what's going on among the top leaders in the military. And Burma and any country where you have a closed society, you know, you have just a multitude of rumors. And so I really can't say for sure what's going on in the mind of Than Shwe or Thein Sein. But I think we just have to look at the facts on the ground and see that so far the reforms are moving forward. I think President Thein Sein is truly committed to economic reform in the country and a degree of political reform. I mean, it's certainly not clear that President Thein Sein and the other top generals who are part of this new government would be prepared to see full democratization in the country. The Constitution says that the military will play a leading role in government, and also that if the military sees that the situation is out of control, that they can stage a coup at any time. Mm-hmm. And those are provisions that the democracy movement want to change in the Constitution. But the process is moving in the right direction, so I think it's very positive.
There, we'll have to leave it. Christina Fink, she's professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. We want to thank you, and also thanks to the technical director there, Stephen Fisher, on the other end in Washington. And Professor Fink, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center with independently owned shops of spirituality and inspiration, like the Bible Education Center, the New Life Church of Faith, and Transitions. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. For over 96 years, generations of farmers have turned to Farm Credit for their financial needs. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit offers products and service geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where we're moving into the last hour of trade for today. Markets closing at 12 o'clock noon Central Time and then not reopening until Thursday morning at 9:30. Corn and soybean futures are trading higher. They've been fueled today by the ongoing fears of deteriorating yield potential amid persistent heat and dryness for Midwest crops. Yesterday afternoon, USDA, on their latest crop progress report, downgrading both corn and soybeans by 8 percentage points in the good to excellent category. Also, traders are acknowledging that the soybean production has no wiggle room for error in 2012, as U.S. inventories are already forecast to dwindle to very tight levels by 2013. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where July wheat is at 777, up 17 and a half. December 816 and a half, up 16 and a quarter. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 774 and a quarter, up 19 and three quarters. December 803, up 12 and a quarter. July corn, 711 and three quarters, up 19 and a quarter. July corn in delivery, it goes off the board on Friday. September